Okay, greetings everyone. Welcome back to our study of Song of Songs. We're picking up with maybe a touch of review at chapter 6, verse 11. We're in the sixth and final cycle of the book, so it won't be long, maybe just next week, and we'll be done and be looking to do something else. So keep that in the back of your mind or in the front of your mind if you like. If you have suggestions of what you'd like to study, I'm all ears. I was compelled by your advice to do Song of Songs and my first stab at it, so I don't feel at all satisfied, but I do feel in some sense content because it's been a wonderful opportunity for me to study this part of God's Word and to put that forward to you in a simple way. So we'll have our invocation and our prayer. We'll get along with the text. We'll look to wrap up next week. And of course, as we think about these themes, we're thinking about them on the three different levels of Solomon and the Shulamite in concrete, and then man and woman, Adam and Eve, more generically or generally. And then, of course, Christ and his church as the complete fulfillment and point of this text. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Okay, so as we look to the start of the sixth cycle, and we got into this just a little bit last week, we're going to recall in the larger context a kind of symmetry that really starts early in chapter 6 with the previous cycle, and that is that Solomon / Christ is in the garden, and the Shulamite / the church is going to pursue him and find him there. So you could see that, for example, in 6:2, my beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze or to graze his sheep in the garden and to gather lilies. And then here in 6:11, she says, I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. So, yeah, true, not identically the garden, but she finds herself in a similarly fruitful and pastoral setting. And then verse 12, before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsman, a prince. So Solomon, along with his entourage, comes to her and finds her. This sort of back and forth we've seen throughout the text, and maybe it's one of the themes that I haven't amplified as much as I should, and that's the beauty of the love that goes back and forth and is in some senses very spontaneous between the two. And I think not only is that fruitful to consider in light of our marriages, that you have the table of duties and you have your baseline responsibilities as a husband, wife, and then God willing as mother and father to your children. But you also have room for spontaneity. You have room for expressions of love just because. And then the same, like gathering your thoughts and experiences in that domain to apply those to God and to think of our relationship with God. Like we have the regular stuff. We have the regular responsibilities and duties of that relationship, and they're delightful to come into his house, to receive his word and his gifts, to proclaim his excellencies amongst all whom we can. But it opens the window to so many other Bible verses that talk about seeking the Lord and pursuing the Lord and examples in Scripture of spontaneous offerings unto the Lord or good deeds done for no other reason than to please the Lord, to seek what is his will, is the language of St. Paul, and then to do it. So maybe it's in our fear of synergism, the fear that we have of that. But as I preached earlier today, not only do the scriptures set us free from that, and the Lutheran confessions themselves set us free from that, we should view ourselves as those whom Christ has converted. That's solely his work. But now that we have been converted, we have free rein to turn to him, to seek him, to run to him, to please him, to love him, by way of the analogy of a husband loving his wife or a wife loving her husband. So I don't know why, I haven't analyzed this or thought deeply enough about it, but even in my own mind there's this kind of thing of like, well, I don't know if that would count. Well, what do you mean by count? Right? Or I don't know if that really registers. It's beyond the norm of our relationship, of the relationship that God has with us as individuals and together as the church. Well, let it be spontaneous. Let it be above the norm. Let it be just an outflowing of the heart. Let it be a love offering unto God. It doesn't even need to be, I commit to do this from henceforth. It doesn't need to be that grandiose. It can be you're at the store and you see something that your wife would like and you buy it and bring it to her. It could be that you see something that might please the Lord, or something pops into your mind that might be pleasing unto the Lord, and you do it for no other reason than that you love him spontaneously and in that moment. So I think that's a wonderful way to think, and wonderfully freeing, and takes us out of this whole like, is it regular? Is it normal? Does it count? You know, and just takes us into this more free and loving relationship with God. So I think that's one of the takeaways we can get from this idea, not only that Solomon pursues the Shulamite, as we know Christ pursues us, but that the Shulamite pursues Solomon, and we are free to pursue and love Christ. Okay, so in any case, that gives us maybe a take-home point from the larger context. In the narrow context, as we discussed in verse 11 and 12 last week, this is clearly Solomon coming to her, Christ coming to us. Now, the others, then, in verse 13, chime in. So often, this has been the daughters of Jerusalem, and maybe that should be our default, unless explicitly otherwise. But they say, return, return, O Shulamite. And here, by the way, is the first time she's called the Shulamite in the text. So the note on 6:13 brings our attention to this. First place, the text calls the bride, quote unquote, the Shulamite. She may be Abishag the Shunammite. You can see the similarity, obviously. The beautiful woman chosen to care for David in his old age. Reference there to 1 Kings. And of course, she never had any sexual relationship or marital relationship with David. So it's maybe in that sense plausible, but still probably unlikely that it would be the same one that now Solomon. Because you remember she's described as a young virgin and King David is described as old and late in his years. So is it possible that after he died, she remained near to the courts, the royal courts, and and Solomon, as he grew up, being approximately her age, fell in love with her, and that's the origin. It's possible, even if it's maybe not all that likely. And the study note kind of hints to as much. The note continues, or it may also be a feminine noun formed from the name Solomon, indicating their relation as husband and wife. So probably like similar to like Shalom and Solomon and Shulamite, that kind of like etymological proximity. In any case, that's all the further that's clear to us is the scriptures simply call her the Shulamite, and the rest is speculation in one form or another. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. So she's gone out to this pastoral, forested, garden-esque scene. The king has come to find her and to retrieve her and to bring her back. Thus the chant, return, return. We all desire to look upon you. Then he speaks in the second half of verse 13. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance between two armies? And you can see from the little superscript, I mean, you can tell right off the bat that it's kind of a tough verse to know what exactly is being said. The little superscript 3 takes you down to the dance of Mahanaim, which is a geographical indicator that recurs. So a little bit of license taken in the interpretation. The study note, let's see, does it give us any indication here? 6:13, it doesn't. So this inspires him toward, I mean, the chapter break here is somewhat artificial because he continues to say, he continues to describe her in what follows. Yeah, and very difficult, very uncertain as to what the sense of it. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance between, maybe as a strange thing or a mysterious thing, maybe something that you desire to look into, like the way that people would look at two armies, the way we would watch a football game or MMA events, with kind of curiosity or curiosity from afar. Perhaps that's the sense. I mean, all of those things are on the table. For my money, it's maybe one of the toughest verses in Song of Songs to really wrap your head around. In any case, he continues to describe her then, and describe her from foot to head. Maybe the most complete physical description of his beloved given here in this section. But of course, we've had similar sections previously, both of them describing each other physically. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O noble daughter. This section all falls under like the little subheading of praise, whereas the previous section fell under the subheading of the search. So how beautiful are your feet in sandals? I mean, in a sense, it rings that language of how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Your rounded thighs are like jewels. You have to be very careful before you put that in your Valentine's Day note to your wives. Your rounded thighs. I don't know. That might evoke some questions. Yeah. It doesn't get better, does it? Your rounded thighs are like jewels. And like jewels, maybe on account of the garment on top and sort of the shimmering nature of that garment. Or it could be, of course, jewels are precious. So like precious, rare, something that I love and desire. In any case, it's poetry. Your mileage may vary. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Well, and it could be, too, that there are differing, whereas beauty, properly speaking, has an objectivity to it, sort of the scope of that beauty changes culture to culture. I mean, there are some cultures where the roundness of the woman is celebrated, maybe even because roundness shows that she's well-loved, well-cared-for, well-provisioned, and good for childbearing and child-raising. In our culture, of course, it's like almost like you can't be too stick thin, right? For women, that's kind of the ideal of beauty. It's kind of a strange ideal. Probably in most cultures, the women who we say that's a perfect body or that's a 10 out of 10 body, other cultures would go, she's starving to death. So there is some difference there. So the rounded thighs and yes, as you the belly as a heap of wheat may be a little cultural shift in terms of the difference of beauty there. Okay, your thighs are like rounded jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. So mixed wine to which was added powdered spice, perhaps pomegranate juice, thus enhancing its flavor. Yeah. So it's hard to know, I mean, quite how sensual this is versus how much it's like more generically like pleasurable, delightful, inviting, more abstract. Right? Is it more concrete and sensual, or is it more abstract and idealistic? That's kind of the question that runs, in my mind at least, throughout this entire section. And maybe the answer is both. Your belly is a heap of wheat. I mean, again, you have wheat and wine in close proximity to each other, evoking the sacramental imagery, but also the imagery of, I mean, from wheat comes bread. So this is fruitfulness. This is food. This is wholesomeness. Wine, that is joy. So you have those themes too, and the themes of the lovers kind of consuming one another, which we've had before, that aspect of love that it's a strange aspect, but the desire to take the other into yourself and to be taken into the other. And that, of course, ultimately has its climax in the Lord's Supper and in the ultimate unity between God and man in Christ Jesus and our enjoyment of God as members of him. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. So that, again, would kind of seem to be the belt, even if it's a decorative kind of belt around her waist, likened to this natural thing, the lilies. So we're going from the feet upward. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. So again, we saw that same imagery earlier. It's difficult for us to wrap our minds around other than fawns and the twins of a gazelle. I mean, these are youthful, graceful, lively, that kind of imagery of the fawn and the gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. We saw that very image in an earlier description. I think it was the Tower of David, if you remember, with the shields around it like a necklace. So returning to that theme. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabim. And I think the study note has some just very brief introduction to these places, these geographical locales. Heshbon, located about 30 miles east of Jerusalem, 21 miles east of Jericho, Bath Rabim, perhaps the name of a gate in Heshbon, or a place to which one could travel after going through the gate. And then coming up, Lebanon has been introduced earlier, the land of the cedar trees, the forests, the hills, kind of a majestic, beautiful place. And then Damascus, ancient Aramean city east of Mount Hermon and far from Jerusalem. Yeah.
I don't know, this just came to me, so I don't even know if there's foundation for it. But I was, while you were reading, I was thinking, he keeps referring to geographical annotations.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible this woman isn't a woman, but really his kingdom?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a theme we've looked at before, and it's a great thing for you to bring to mind. In some ways, she's the description of the promised land.
Yeah.
Wine and wheat, the tower, which would presumably be in Jerusalem, Heshbon, and then especially like Lebanon and Damascus and Carmel would be the full extent of Solomon's kingdom. So the full fullest extent of the promised land.
Even the craggy rocks and everything he says has some geographical bent to it in some ways.
Yeah. And then you can see the image how like the people and the land are one in God's eye, and he loves them both as one and the same. And it's not a way that we're accustomed to thinking, but we should. It's kind of a Gnostic way of thinking where, well, it has to do with our current situation too, where, I mean, you might grow up somewhere else in the country and then move and live for the rest of your life in some kind of very different geographical place. Much more normal, historically speaking, is that a people and then you yourself as an individual are shaped by your environment, even physically, and of course culturally shaped by your environment, and are really one with your land. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why are there a lot of white-skinned people along the equator? No. Are there a lot of dark-skinned people in the extreme north? No. Because even the nature of our skin color is shaped by geography, ultimately. So we are more intimately connected with the land than we know, or than we modern people know or recognize or realize. So I think this is a totally natural thought, too, that God sees his people and the land as one and loves and cherishes them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so thank you for bringing that to our mind again. It should be at the forefront of our minds throughout this meditation. Okay, so eyes like pools in Heshbon, by the gate of Bath-Rabim. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus. So again, I don't know how flattering this is to an ancient woman's ears, but clearly the point is one that is geographically tied. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and Carmel is this great mountain. Yeah, 7.5 the note, Carmel mountain ridge south of Haifa along Israel's coast, lower than the peaks of Lebanon, but no doubt still majestic. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. So obviously purple is associated with royalty. And it's hard to know, like, does she have a purple veil on? Probably. Although the flowing locks would be more explicit to hair. So is the hair underneath the purple veil, or is the hair itself? Black hair isn't always black. My wife has this, like her hair is like if you just looked at it, you'd say it's very dark black. But as you come up, it's like got all these auburn and red hues in it. So maybe it's more like that. Like the black is so black, it's got purple hues to it. Hard to know. Flowing locks are like purple. I mean, that'd be the most literal take. And then a king is held captive in the tresses, which is kind of interesting imagery because the tresses is just the flowing locks. I mean, it's another name for hair. So it's hard. The imagery is hard there. Like he's captivated by the beauty. Okay. I mean, is he actually like entangled by the beauty, encompassed and held by the beauty? Maybe. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's tough to know with any precision, I mean. Okay, so I think that's the end. And you can kind of see the editors have hit enter between verse 5 and verse 6. There's a space there. Indicating a kind of unit that begins with the description of the feet in 7:1 and works all the way up to the locks of the hair at the end of verse 5. The description continues, but it seems like that meditation per se is done, and now a more holistic meditation or praise comes about in the following verses. How beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one, with all your delights. And as the little superscript says, or among delights. So in other words, you're the most delightful of all the delightful things, would be the sentiment. 7, or your statue is like a palm tree, which would tend to lean towards the thin and tall, more what we would think of in the West as beauty standards of beauty. And your breasts are like its clusters. So kind of interesting for us, we have all these imported palm trees around. It's my understanding none of them are native. They've all been brought in. But to have these palm trees, these ladies all around us. Then he said, I say I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruit. It's kind of a hilarious image. Oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine. So this connection to a breast is one that is maybe not well understood by men and yet present in most men. But it's kind of hard to know why. It's kind of strange to think about. I mean, we know that breasts are used for nursing and nursing infants. So there's a kind of connection there to the fertility and the fruitfulness and the support of progeny. But yeah, then there's just also something else. Okay, don't need to belabor that point. But remember, like, there's even, I think, this proverb, to be satisfied with the breasts of your wife, right? To be content with what God has given you. But what the connection is with the breasts, again, is kind of mysterious. I mean, it's experienced, but is it known? I don't know. All right. And the scent of your breath like apples. And that's interesting because, of course, there's been the eating of apples multiple times before as a kind of pleasure and delight. And so maybe this is more than saying just like, oh, you've got fresh breath, or you've got, but like, you have the breath of, yeah, I don't know, I'm making it too abstract, but obviously it's like an imagery and symbol of love and consummation, literally consuming, and the scent of your breath reflecting this. And your mouth like the best wine. So a kind of parallel there, breath like apples, mouth like wine. The superscript says palate. I don't know that that means anything other than mouth, quite literally in this context. Okay, so the geographical and the natural, the things of beauty you find in nature, are all ascribed to this woman and the love. So you can, I mean, in a sense, to just kind of abstract it to that third level, Christ delighting in us as creatures amidst creation, the church for whom the creation was made and from whom she is called forth in Adam first and then in Eve through Adam, and the love that Christ has for her in this state, all on view here. The last part of this subsection, praise, that extends from verse 1 is the second half of verse 9, where now she, the Shulamite slash the church, speaks. It goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. Yeah, and it's the superscript is weird. In these other, the Septuagint, the Syriac, and the Vulgate translations, you have, that's what it is in those versions. And then the Hebrew puts it more difficultly, causing the lips of sleepers to speak. Yeah, that's a hard one. In any case, I don't think thematically it's too hard to grasp why this follows: the scent of your breath like apples, your mouth like the best wine. And then what is she talking about? Like, probably the wine. It goes down, it being the wine, goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. So the delights and joys of wine, the intoxication, all being a kind of a real thing being partaken of, but also a deeper metaphor for the love, the drinking in of the love, the buzz and the enjoyment and the relaxation and exhilaration of drinking wine, like likened unto the love itself. That's probably what's going on here. All right, let me pause there now that I've done my best to explain some difficult verses. Maybe you see something much more clearly than I do. Maybe you have an easy explanation or a better explanation. That's certainly likely. But any thoughts or any reflections you have on this section? Yes, sir. Oh, 1 second. Let's get you the mic.
On 7:6, the word pleasant, is there any indication in the original text whether that refers to simply the external appeal or her disposition?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know, and I didn't look at the original. I didn't bring those tools with me. My suspicion is no. My suspicion is there's not any indication which way it's to be taken. But as a reader, I would tend to take it as both. Yeah. So the beautiful and the pleasant. So because we're talking in ideals here, it's like the beauty and the person, the beautiful internal and the beautiful external are one. Yeah, there's not a difference there. Whereas in a fallen world, there can be a difference, especially as like our outer bodies decay. But the inner man grows and is renewed day by day. So there's a reality that happens to us where the inner man becomes more beautiful over time, while the external man becomes less beautiful over time.
Or you can find a beautiful model who you just don't want to be around.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And that's like the best, that is some of the best training for young men. I mean, young men have to come to that conclusion. Because there are some women that the world holds up as beautiful, and when you just look at their face, you can understand why they say she's beautiful, but all you see is haughtiness and arrogance and worldliness. And like, I mean, without even making that conscious mental move, you go, I'm not attracted to her. Yeah, she's ugly. She looks like wickedness. Yeah. And many such cases, unfortunately, amongst our celebrities or whatever women are promoted, it's hard to see. I mean, because they're just such fallen people that it's hard to not see the fallenness on their face. Yeah. Whereas there's another equal mystery there, and that is that some women who look extremely plain look so in a pious way, and it's that same thing where you all of a sudden you have a different eye for beauty, because the piety and the godliness and the humility and the lack of makeup and a boob job is like actually what's attractive, because you go, oh, I bet, you know, what's on the inside is coming out through the wholesomeness of the outside. And so someone who the world would not hold up and say she's a 10, a godly man might look at her and say, that's a 10. Yeah. Kind of cuts both ways. Thanks for that. That's exactly right. Yeah, and how many of our quote-unquote, like, our culture's idea of the beautiful woman, you know, they're held up, and then it's like 5 years later, they're unrecognizable because of all the surgery they've had or whatever else, right? I mean, this kind of like a horrible warning, and I'm not trying to pick on an individual per se. I mean, in many ways, I pity her, but she's a wicked woman. But do you remember Madonna?
Yeah.
Madonna from the 80s was like, I don't know. I mean, and maybe it's generational, but she was a little older than me. I remember looking up to her and just thinking, well, there's the peak and epitome of American beauty. You know, she's got it all. She's singing, she's successful and everything else. I mean, now what does she look like? Like, first of all, you could not, like, unless you knew, you could not connect the two people together. And she's really kind of the external has followed the course of what was really there internally all along. So very tragic. But in other words, my point is to illustrate that eventually that ugliness kind of plays itself out, even on a physical level. Okay, so yeah, that's a good thing to think about, the holistic nature of people, the inside and the outside, and some different dynamics to consider. So chapter 7 ends with the next subsection, which is titled the invitation, which would start with 7:10. Still the words of the woman, I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Now, not to overread the text, but this is a wonderful sentiment and alien to American way of thinking, because I am my beloved's. Her joy is saying, I'm the possession of another. It's a rare woman, American woman, who would say, that's my joy. My joy is to be the object that another possesses. I'm not an object. Stop objectifying me. I'm my own person. I'm independent. My sense of self-worth comes from my own independence. Just a very, if this is feminine, that's a very anti-feminine view. She rejoices that she belongs to her beloved, and she finds a sense of identity in that. I'm his. And that works at the level of Solomon and the Shulamite, these two individuals. It works at the level of husband and wife. And of course, all the more familiar to us, it works at the level of Christ and the church. We rejoice that we belong to him and are his possession, that he has headship over us, that we submit to him, that we are his. Okay, I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. So she delights that he desires her. Which is different, too, than the kind of American abstracted ideal of just being desirable. Like, this is really kind of a toxic thing. Men and women today desire to be attractive. Attractive to who? To everyone. That itself is kind of an adulterous bent. Especially that comes into focus when you look at his desire is for me. She's delighting. She wants to make herself desirable for him, not for everyone. It's a pretty big difference if you think about it. So she delights that his desire is exclusive to her, and she desires to be desirable to him, not to everyone. Okay, this continues seamlessly in 11, even though we have the little subheading there, the bride gives her love. Really, it just flows right on the heels of what came before. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. The note there says, or among the henna plants. So I don't know linguistically what's behind the distinction there. The henna plants actually might make more sense given the agrarian and natural imagery of the fields, and then what comes next, the vineyards, the vines, the blossoms, the pomegranates, etc. It probably makes a little more sense than lodging in the villages. Let's see if the note says anything. The Shulamite envisions the exchange of marital intimacy among the flora of the field. I mean, that is another thing that just shows how much we've lost. Because now, if you were to make love out in a field, you could get arrested. In a pre-fallen world, that would be a completely natural and wonderful thing. No further comment is needed, probably. And then it says, this imagery is like the bliss encountered earlier in the song. Yeah, it's true. So you have, again, this is invitation, but in many ways it's consummation too. Come, my beloved, let us go into the fields and lodge in the villages. I sure prefer the henna plants given the context. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded. So that's fertility language, right? It's coded, but that's what it is. Whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom. So this kind of connection with the fertility of nature and the fertility of man and woman, which of course is exploited by the pagans. That connection and that obvious reality is exploited amongst the pagans and turned into a kind of fertility god or goddess worship, right? So you can see how that whole thing is perverted. But just because it's perverted and that's the main way we know it, doesn't mean that there isn't a kind of kernel of truth there and a kind of harmony with nature. I mean, that also is what lies behind this text that we're so missing in our modern world, is not only is the world not ours, you can't just go out and freely be and freely love, you'll get arrested, but also there's a disconnect from nature. We're not rising and we're not going to sleep when the sun sets, we're not rising when the sun rises, we're not in harmony with the rest of nature and taking our cues in life, so that when nature begins to blossom and bud, so do the affections of man and woman. That we seem to be very disconnected from that. In the same way, we don't sleep in accordance with nature. We don't think procreatively in accordance with nature. We're disconnected. That's really my point. We're just disconnected from the natural flow of creation around us. It would not have been so in Eden and looking forward to the new heavens and the new earth. I mean, we're talking apples and oranges. We're talking totally different categories, but we will be in harmony with nature and nature in harmony with us. The creation and us will all be one and experienced as such. So maybe that's all the meditation there is that you see here is a kind of Eden, like when we read this, it almost hurts. It's almost like longing for home. It's that feeling of what was lost or the beauty of creation, what could have been kind of on display. In that sense, it cuts like the law. It shows what we lack, what we've lost. And in another sense, it pushes us forward in hope to what is to come and to what God intends, and what we have restored to us in Christ Jesus is a holistic restoration. Okay, and then I don't want to overread or overanalyze this. You've got the vineyards, which have been everywhere in view, and of course are such a prominent imagery in the scriptures of the church and God's love for the church. You've got the vines and the blossoms and the grape blossoms, so more vineyard and wine imagery. The pomegranates, not only kind of a delight, but connected with the temple and part and parcel of the design of the temple. Then she says, "There I will give you my love," thus the study note that we read a few moments ago. "The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved." So again, it's a feast of love, a feast of creation, everything in harmony and everything in one. And that's ultimately what we long for in the new heavens and the new earth with our Lord Jesus. Everything restored back to harmony. Okay, any thoughts on that section? Y'all are leaving me out on a limb here to interpret and to bear the consequences of that interpretation. You don't want to join me in speculating. That's safe and wise. Okay, chapter 8, verse 1, which again really is kind of a break that doesn't need to be there, because if anything, you have maybe just another subsection starting, and that's what the editors of the study Bible think. They think that 8, 1 through 4 is now a new section that they call longing. But again, as you can tell, it's just all part and parcel of her same speech, monologue. So this is going to be strange to our ears, but I think I'll be able to get the sense across, or you'll be able to capture the sense for yourself. "Oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed at my brother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you and none would despise me." So what she's likening this to is that it's completely socially acceptable to say to your brother, "I love you," publicly, and to hug him and even to kiss him on the cheek. Nobody's going to bat an eye. And she says, so this is the longing. I can't, you know, oh, that you were like this so I could show my affection to you publicly and no one would bat an eye. But that's not the case. So expressive of desiring something that she does not yet have. If I found you outside, I would kiss you and none would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. I would give you spiced wine to drink. So this house of the mother arose earlier in the dream, if you remember. But because they weren't married, it was inappropriate. It became a kind of nightmare. But if that's back in chapter 3, verse 4, where she's in the midst of her dream. And she says, I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her who conceived me. Okay, so 3, 4. So mothers of both the Shulamite and Solomon play a supportive role in their marriage in this section here in chapter 3, as well as in 8. Chapter 8, verses 1 through 2 and 5, which is the section we're in right now. In regard to the chamber, the Shulamite brings Solomon to the bedchamber of her mother, as she would later arouse Solomon beneath the apple tree where his mother conceived and gave birth to him. So again, I think it maybe what's not clear to us is that at root in this sentiment is the wholesomeness of everything being out in the open and upfront and appropriate and known by the families, and the families are rejoicing in this. So let's take a look now at the notes. Yeah, on 8, 1 and 2. The Shulamite desires unbridled public freedom to openly express her love for Solomon, as she would publicly express love for a brother. Outside I would kiss you, that phrase of hers. In ancient Israel, it was not customary to express marital intimacy publicly. And then 8:2, where she refers to the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. 8:2 says, the Shulamite's mother doubtlessly trained her from youth in the way she should live. Mature women are to continue to instruct and set examples for younger women. Titus chapter 2, verses 3 through 4. So, I think that behind this too is, just as my mother was a good wife to my father, so also she has taught me to be a good wife to my husband. So that's what I mean by the public nature of it, like the family accepts this, and the wholesome and integrative nature of it. It's our turn in the line of an upright family who is living as God would have us live. That seems to be the sentiment of these verses, especially verse 2. I would give you, second half of verse 2, I would give you spiced wine to drink. So again, it's really hard to read Song of Songs and be a Baptist. Because wine is everywhere. And wine is part of love. And if I could be just crass, part of love making throughout this entire text. So I would give you spiced wine to drink. And then she says, the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. So that's an image that goes all the way throughout. I don't know how many times that phrase has recurred. So the wine, the sacramental imagery, and of course there's wine in the sacrifices and the pomegranate with the temple again. So I don't think these things are just taken by chance. I think they're connected to the religious life of Israel as on the various three levels we talked about, the third level being Christ and his church. Wine and pomegranates continue to emerge. His left hand under my head, his right hand embraces me is like a phrase throughout this text. Like I said, I would guess 3 or 4 times or earlier we've heard that same refrain. And then she says, likewise 3 or 4 times before, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. So again, that's almost Solomon breaking the fourth wall and saying, listen, I know that what I've written is enticing, but it's meant to be done in its proper and right place. We're in an awkward spot because we could just about finish. Maybe we'll go for it. Okay, that is the end of the sixth cycle. The sixth of the six cycles, as the editors have laid it out for us. What follows then is the conclusion. And I say it with a little bit of reserve, just because we're still kind of in the middle of her speech. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Under the apple tree, I awakened you. You know, and you wonder that phrase, who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Doesn't that sound like something the others or the daughters of Jerusalem would say? And then she continues with the first person. Under the apple tree, I awakened you. So if you're in 4, I adjure you, O daughters, that's clearly the female speaking. Who is that coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? Like what? Is she reflecting on herself in her mind's eye? I guess that's possible. Or you'd have the others / the daughters of Jerusalem asking, who is that coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved in reference to the woman? And then in any case, under the apple tree, I awakened you picks back up with the first person. So, I don't know if the editors maybe missed that or if they saw that, but ultimately weighed that it wasn't enough. Well, let's get on to the important part anyway. Under the apple tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you, where she who bore you was in labor. So, yeah, it's this connecting with the matriarchal lines and this continuation of the lines. I mean, there's a lot to contemplate. It's not very clear. A lot to contemplate and speculate on in regards to this imagery. The note says, consummation of their marital love occurs at the place where the bridegroom was conceived, namely beneath the apple tree. Which you have to wonder thematically. The apple tree has been an Edenic image all the way through. And in a sense, where was Christ conceived? Now, this is absolutely poetic. In a sense, he was conceived at the foot of the foot of the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, where God said to the serpent, the seed of the woman will crush your head. In a sense, with that word, was he conceived and the purpose for which he was conceived. So then when the consummation of Christ and his church takes place, it takes place at the very site where God promised and conceived Christ to enter the world and crush the serpent's head. That's what I think. Now, is that too much of a stretch or too speculative? I'll let you be the judge of that. But I suspect that that's at the deepest level or at the level 3 level, Christ and his church, that's what the Holy Spirit has in mind ultimately with this imagery, is to evoke the mystery of Christ and the first promise of Christ being brought to its full telos. Okay, in any case, verse 6, set me as a seal upon your heart. So you would normally like seal a scroll or something like that. Set me as a seal upon your heart. You would set that as a, you would put your name or like your signet ring, you would press it into it like that's your name, that's your identity, like almost putting your name on something. So that's probably the imagery here. Set me as a seal upon your heart is like write my name into your heart, let my name be upon your heart, something to that effect. As a seal upon your arm. Usually the arm is like obviously what you're doing stuff with, or fighting with or defending with. So that may, or working with. So that may be the sense, like, let your provision and protection, like, let the remembrance of me inspire you unto your provision and protection of me. That too is a little bit of a stretch, because it's just, it is what it is. The text says what it says, and trying to discern the meaning is difficult. The note says the cylindrical seal or signet ring, often marked with one's name or monogram, was pressed into wax or clay as a legal mark of authentication. May have been an amulet dangling above the heart. If the Shulamite were Solomon's seal, then she bore his name. Oh, I see. So passively, she's the seal of Solomon. Yeah, that makes some sense, I guess. I don't know which is which. The love that is personified in the song makes one think of God's love. And then, for love is stronger than death, maybe just one of the greatest lines out of the text when we think of Christ. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. And here's jealousy as the parallel to love. So what does the note say? Ardor, yeah, strong or passionate love. So I think we've talked about this before, that I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, that he loves jealously. And jealous love is the best love, because it means rightly ordered love. He is jealous for his people. If they love other gods, that's an offense to him. He is their God. He loves them and wants them to love him exclusively. So to the husband's wife properly, the husband and wife, their loves for one another are likewise jealous loves. If the husband loves other women and the wife doesn't care, that's a problem. If the wife loves other men and the husband doesn't care, that's a problem. So the nature of rightly ordered love is a jealous love, even a possessive love, and a love that is unique and exclusive. So that's why I think jealousy is a great word here, especially in English, because it is provocative. For love is strong as death. And of course, as we find out, is even stronger. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. And indeed, in a sense, even fiercer than the grave, because God calls us forth from death and the grave. Such is his love, such is his jealousy for us. Obviously, you can see what this would mean just on the level one between the Shulamite and Solomon, or level two between a husband and a wife. This is properly ordered love. Like, this is why, there have been sad examples of this, but like the wife is found cheating and the husband, in a fit of rage, commits a crime, and he is either not punished for that crime or the punishment is very light. These sorts of crimes of passion. We all know that that's kind of a component of rightly ordered love, and the feeling one gets when that rightly ordered love is betrayed. So for love is strong as death, jealousy is fierce as the grave, is probably like the superficial, like level one kind of reading of what's meant there. Its flashes are flashes of fire, so most likely lightning is what's in view, the very flame of the Lord. It's kind of a beautiful image, powerful image of rightly ordered love and its strength and its ferocity and its brilliance and power likened unto lightning. So we're not used to thinking of love this way, and maybe this is helpful for us as men, because it's a pretty masculine view of love. Strong, fierce, flashes of fire like lightning, the very flame of the Lord who is himself love, who is himself a consuming fire. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. So that is, if he were to trade it in. And obviously that's true. So this is appealing to a universal human understanding that love is more valuable than anything else, than all earthly treasures. So to love and to be loved it's equally true of both aspects. It's worth more than anything else in the world. that's probably it. But unfortunately, we got too far, or not far enough. So let's just plan on next week picking up with the heading Final Advice. This is all part of the conclusion that began in verse 5. We'll do a little recap, and we'll just see how it goes. But, I mean, the likelihood is, because nobody wants me to drag out the next 7 or 8 verses for an entire hour. So probably we'll get started next week with something new, or at least the introduction to something new. So that just puts the pressure on you all. Now you have even less time to let me know what you want to do. Otherwise, I get to pick, and that's always dangerous. The Lord be with you.